From Foreign Policy, I'm Amy McKinnon, sitting in for Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, what's next for the Dreamers? Last week, the Supreme Court announced it would hear an appeal that would decide the fate of nearly 1 million young people living in the United States.
That means that it's not going to hear this case until the fall, and then whatever it rules on DACA will undoubtedly be part of the presidential election campaign.
The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, known as DACA, is an Obama-era program which protects the Dreamers from deportation. Dreamers are children who were brought to the United States illegally or who are living here with expired visas. In September 2017, then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the administration's plans to end DACA.
I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
But after that announcement, four different federal appeals courts prevented that from happening.
The court said that the decision was, quote, arbitrary and capricious because the administration, quote, failed to give a reasoned explanation for the change in policy.
The issue has been a political lightning rod. A month ago, the Democratic-led U.S. House of Representatives voted to create a pathway to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants, including children who were brought to the United States as minors. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Kentucky Republican, told Fox News Radio that the bill was unlikely to go anywhere.
Just yesterday, House Democrats took a brief hiatus from their bickering over impeachment. They actually passed something, which is this DREAM Act. Will that bill get a vote in the U.S. Senate as written?
Probably not. You know, there's some genuine fixes on the legal immigration side and on the illegal immigration side that need to be addressed.
So you'd want the DREAM Act paired with...
I would. I think there's...
The stalling of legislation in Congress is worrisome for Dreamers who have been lobbying for status in the United States for well over a decade. And with so much attention being put on the immigration crisis at the southern border, many of them fear their plight has been forgotten. The journalist Laura Wides Munoz followed the lives of several young Dreamers and then wrote a book about them titled The Making of a Dream, How a Group of Young Undocumented Immigrants Helped Change What It Means to Be American. She spoke with First Person host Sarah Wildman last month before the Supreme Court announcement.
Laura, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for having me.
Remind us what the DREAM Act is.
So the DREAM Act is the Development, Relief, and Education Act for Alien Minors. It's a big mouthful, but it was this proposal that came up for the first time in 2001. It was the first time it was read out. And the idea was that there was this growing number of unaccompanied young minors in the U.S., and they had sort of gotten into the system and they were here, but now they were turning 18. And what happens to them? So the idea was that they could get to go to college and eventually get on track for green card and citizenship. But originally, people often forget, it was really about education because you couldn't even go to college at that point in most states if you were undocumented.
There was sort of a groundswell of understanding that there were many, many thousands of children in this country who didn't have access to in-state tuition, but they also couldn't necessarily even...
They couldn't even go in because you're not a foreign student. You have there's no place for you. And then there was just sort of the idea that these kids had been here for many, many years, and now they were turning 18, and what do we do with them?
How did you start following this?
I had been covering immigration in Los Angeles and in Miami, and the Dreamers were sort of on my radar. I mean, certainly had begun to see them, but it really wasn't until about 2009 when I was looking for this story. Kind of the end of the year, it was a slow period at work. I was at the AP, and I got this invitation to go hear about these young people who are walking from Miami to Washington in the middle of winter. It was a little crazy, but it was interesting, so I went there. And I heard these four young people speak, Felipe Salsa Rodriguez, Isabel Salsa Rodriguez, Gabby Pacheco, and Carlos Roa. And there's just this thing about them, this determination, this innocence, and this bravado, this swagger, all wrapped together that was incredibly compelling. And they wanted to call attention to the fact that they had no status in the U.S. They had grown up here. Some of them were very good students. And they were just asking to have some reprieve from getting deported, which, of course, is what ended up happening. They did get temporary protections. But at that time, the, you know, comprehensive immigration reform movement was just dead in the water. They had tried a number of times. And there was sort of this loss of direction. What were we going to do? And these young people just galvanized the country when they walked, and they didn't even have jackets. It was cold. They had to stop and get off their walk and buy jackets because north of Miami, it's really cold. And a few months later, by the end of the year, they had the first vote for the DREAM Act, and it passed in the House under then-Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and it failed by 5 votes in the Senate. But that told me there was something going on, and I thought I'd got to document this for posterity.
And that very first march that you described from Miami to D.C., did you participate on the march with them?
No, so I went, it was New Year's Day, I got up early and just walked with them, you know, that first bit, and then followed them and wrote about it. And by the time they reached Washington in April, they had generated headlines around the world.
What did it feel like in that crowd? What was that crowd like?
There was just this tremendous energy and hope and idealism that, but also desperation, because you don't march, I don't know, 1,300 miles if you take detours, because I did a bunch of detours. You don't march like that if you have any other option. I mean, it was exhausting. They had disgusting blisters on their feet and backs were thrown out. They were sleeping in, you know, the basements or wherever they could. So there was a desperation that I didn't see after that for a long time amid, you know, for many of them once they began to have a voice. And now, you know, now we're starting to see it again.
One of the things about undocumented immigrants in general, let alone children, is that there is this fear of exposure. Was there reticence on their part? How did you get access?
It was really hard. On the one hand, I had been covering immigration for more than a decade, so I knew a lot of people, and I had built up a body of work, and I was trusted as a journalist. But certainly, when I first started, there was no protection. People were very scared, and so it was a lot of discussion. The people I ended up choosing were all people who, by the time I started writing really researching and writing the book in 2013 and 14, whose lives had been in the public sphere already. And so I wasn't worried that I was outing them and thus setting them up for being targets. And so I had to build a lot of trust. There were a lot of people who said no. There were a lot of people who felt that they so represented major organizations that they didn't want to delve into their personal lives. I wanted people who, you know, really could tell the real story, you know, the mistakes, the truths, the doubts, all of that, not just sort of the talking points.
Who was the first person that you started to follow?
I had covered the story of Marie Gonzalez, who was in the middle of the country in Jefferson City, Missouri, when her case was first unfolding in 2005.
So Marie's story is really interesting because her father worked for the governor's office, which means he was really integrated into a very mainstream system, but was undocumented.
Right. And someone outed him. He was working for the governor. He worked in the mailroom. And actually, he'd been lauded as a hero because right after 9/11 and there was the anthrax scare, they had gotten a bunch of envelopes with white powder and he had found it and it was a huge thing. And so he was lauded as sort of a hero. But some of that attention, I think, someone called the governor's office and outed him as being undocumented. And then not only that, I think then leaked it to the press. So the governor's office had to take action. So he was fired and the family was put into deportation hearings. And this was really significant because she was one of the first undocumented youths to speak out publicly with their case and have organizations take up our case. And the reason why, in some ways, she could speak out so forcefully and come to Washington and stand up and give her name is because she was already in deportation proceedings. There was sort of nothing to lose at that point.
How old was Marie when she came?
She was a toddler. She was very young. She doesn't remember her native country of Costa Rica at all.
And there's this sense around the children, around the dreamers themselves, that they're blameless, right? That becomes kind of a theme. But if the children are blameless, then someone is to blame. But the children actually really struggle with the idea of blaming their parents for this.
Right. It's, I mean, it is true. They came as kids. They didn't make that choice. They've grown up here. On the other hand, it sort of begs the question of who's to blame. And Marie would talk about going to speak to Congress and just feeling this visceral nausea because she felt like she was throwing her parents under the bus. And I think that over time, as the youth movement has gained strength, they've really tried to reshape that narrative so that there's less talk of through no fault of their own because they no longer want to throw their parents under the bus in that same way, even as they are, you know, many are supporting a bill that would simply focus on them.
Marie does get deferred action on her own case, but her parents don't. And a lot of these families are divided. How did Marie handle that?
It was very hard. I mean, at 19, she's sort of orphaned in the United States. She goes to college, gets a scholarship, but she talks about living in people's basements. It was very isolating. And it was amazing because this community that really didn't even realize they had any undocumented immigrants amongst them and, you know, were pretty conservative in Missouri, they came to her aid and were incredibly supportive. And I think the people who knew her and saw her case started to rethink many issues that they had sort of assumed they understood. But it really affected her relationship with her family. And she didn't see her parents again for 5 years. And, you know, it really breaks those ties in many ways.
The question, I guess, then is it a win for her to get to stay?
I mean, I think that's a complicated question. She's now married. She's a U.S. citizen. She has two kids here. This is her home. So for her, it is a win, but it's a win that has always comes with a veil of pain for the separation that it created with her family and her parents.
Was there something unique about the end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s that sort of coalesced this group?
I mean, one thing is people are staying longer. So instead of before our immigration laws became tougher and tougher in 96 toward 2000, people would cross the border back and forth, and so their families might stay. Mm-hmm. Now their families were coming to join them because you couldn't go back and forth, and so those kids are coming and staying. That's one thing. You then have this bigger group, but you also have the rise of social media. And so these kids have this outlet, have a source for getting their message out. They could take an iPhone and start filming, and they really did. And they kind of pioneered that in-your-face confrontation that then goes immediately to social media. And that's part of it. And then I think there's also, you know, a change in demographics. As there is a growth in immigrants in the United States, there's more of a recognition of others that are here and some of the challenges that they're facing, legal or not legal.
There's also a strong adopting of civil rights language, right? They start reading Martin Luther King, and there's a lot of intersection between LGBTQ activism. And several of the young people you follow are actually fall under the umbrella of LGBTQ as well.
I didn't go into this thinking I was going to write a story about intersectional movements. It's, you know, that was sounded very complicated. But, you know, I saw it on the ground is exactly what was happening. And there were a large number of LGBTQ individuals who became leaders within the immigrant rights movement. And I think there's a lot of reasons. I mean, one is I think they felt even more vulnerable than many undocumented immigrants because they're isolated from the greater public. And then within their own community, they may not be accepted. So finding this movement gave them an anchor, gave them a safe space, people who were caring and loving. And so they became leaders there. At the same time, since they were already independent, I think they were maybe more accustomed to taking that risk and embracing that fear of standing out and putting yourself out there on the line. So there's that. And in some places, it actually felt like a safer place to come out as undocumented even than as LGBTQ, amazingly enough.
Let's look at another one of the narratives of the people you followed, Jareth Andrade. Tell me about how you met her.
Wow. I got her name through other activists. And her story was very fascinating because she had come here shortly before 9/11 with her grandparents, with the idea her parents would later come. But then they couldn't get visas as a result of 9/11. And so she didn't see them again for 5 years. And she was, I think, 8 when she first came here.
She came from Bolivia.
From Bolivia, yes. So she grew up here. Eventually her parents came and they had to reconnect and recreate that bond.
Jareth gets a call from her father, who is being held in county jail because he's rolled a stop sign. He's also been drinking.
Yeah. He had been going out. He ran a company, electrical contractor, and he took his staff out for dinner, and he drove home, and he had had too much to drink, and he was pulled over. And he was so terrified that he immediately told them everything. And within 48 hours, he was sent to a detention center miles and miles away.
Where were they living at the time?
They were in Virginia. And in no way do I want to condone driving under the influence in any shape or form. No one should do it, period. It is interesting, you know, just to consider the penalties in the U.S. for, you know, first violation of DUI. They're pretty light in many places. If you're an undocumented immigrant, father who works, you know, raising your kids, all of that, no other issues, you get one of those, you're deported and you can't come back for a decade.
One of the things, though, about Harrod's father is that he is actually an architect in Bolivia and comes to this country and can't practice his profession, which is a pretty typical story, right? You can have an expertise, but then you come to this country, and if you don't have papers, you end up working in much more menial capacities.
Right.
And I'm curious about what that does for your sense of self and your self-confidence and how you parent.
There are a lot of issues that go into living a life where you're in the country illegally. You're illegal, you know, just in terms of how you teach your children to react when there are police around, how you teach your children, you know, the fact that Haritha never even told her best friend about her status, that she learned, you know, she learned it later. It sort of just came out. I mean, she knew she'd come here. She knew she was an immigrant, but she just didn't understand what the status was until many years later. So there's just all sorts of impacts on the family over time for, you know, living in this position. But what's interesting is that Haritha became the leader of the family, and she had already been a burgeoning young activist. She was actually inspired by the walk from Florida. And so all of a sudden she found herself not only advocating for herself as a dreamer, but now for her father. And she sort of, I mean, at one point she ended up speaking to, you know, a room of, I don't know, 1,000 AFL-CIO labor leaders and getting them on their feet to demand that her father not be deported. And she's this, you know, small young woman. And it was an incredible moment and demonstrated to me the power that some of these young people can exert.
So, but even though she does go before the AFL-CIO and she makes this impassioned speech to save her father, which works, a lot of times that deportation process is so fast.
Right.
So she's actually able to halt something, but that in and of itself sounds like it was fairly lucky.
Right. Most people don't get that opportunity. And, you know, obviously, you know, the number of immigration judges that in this country has been woefully low. They've been retiring at high numbers for years and years. I wrote a story about this, I think, back in 2011, saying there's going to be a huge, huge lag where we won't have enough people to process these cases. And of course, now we're in that situation. You know, and most of these people don't have lawyers. They're not guaranteed any lawyer. And there's, you know, there are very good arguments for the fact that if you gave a lawyer to every single person who came to the United States and wanted to get asylum, you would have everyone would be able to stretch out their case forever. And, you know, it would just be a tremendous drain on our resources. And so that's often been the argument for why we don't have
lawyers.
What's
the story with Harrod's father now?
He's here. He continues to work. Her sister's born in the U.S. and she's in school.
There's a number of moments that are very sad and difficult in the book. I mean, one is just the strange windows that are missed, that there's supposed to be a hearing about dreamers the day after 9/11, the economic crisis, and even the week that it's Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I think that's...
It's repealed.
Repealed.
The same day, just right after, almost immediately after, the first DREAM Act vote in the Senate, it just fails by 5 votes.
There's something about that that makes you feel like the civil rights movement is still in some respects in its infancy in this context.
This movement.
Yeah.
I think at the in the legislative area, it is still obviously a huge uphill battle. But it's not like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 came, you know, after 1 year of activism. I mean, you know, African-American civil rights leaders have been, you know, leading this charge with allies for many, many decades. So actually what's interesting is when that bill failed, some of the Dreamer activists that came out, and they were just devastated. And the LGBTQ activists said, hey, it took us 14 years to get this passed. And they were so young, and I thought, God, we can't wait 14 years. But the big thing that's changed, and that's something I talk about and kind of was surprised by, is how much the culture and the conversation has changed. And when these guys started, you know, they didn't even want to come out and say that they were undocumented at all to their teachers, to anyone. Now I speak to educators and college administrators all the time who are trying to figure out how to deal with this population and provide services. And you see it, you know, in books, TV shows, pop culture. Grey's Anatomy had an old episode about a doctor who was undocumented. There's going to be a new Party of Five where the parents are deported. It's now talked about. It's not a secret anymore. And so in some ways, the rest of the country that's not immediately affected can't just turn away and has to confront this issue that's in the middle of our nation. And I think that's the first step.
Some of your characters, I remember there are two women who turned to each other and realized that they're both undocumented and they had kept it from each other.
Hareth and her best friend, yes.
And I'm curious about that. Like, how did you get into those details?
Luckily for me, many of the people, as I said, had been in public sphere. So Marie's case, for example, there was documentation, including videos done of the day her parents left. So I could watch that and then check it with her mother, who I interviewed, and her husband and others who knew her then. So a lot of it was documented. Dario, who is a young man who goes to Harvard and is from L.A., originally from Mexico, his family did a lot of home videos. And so I had a lot of videos from his childhood that I could look at. In Hareth's case, some of it was documented once her father got in the sphere of deportation. But in her case, that instance, I talked to her friend, her mother, who she had told at the time, and just through many different interviews recreated that scene.
Dario is a great person to bring up because he goes to Harvard. He's obviously very smart, but he also makes a lot of mistakes. And one of the things is that these are kids.
Right, these are kids, and there's so much pressure on them to be sort of the perfect. You know, when they first came out, it was like they'd wear these graduation gowns and, you know, they're the top of their class, and there was so much pressure on them to be sort of the perfect human being, and that took its toll. But then it also left so many people, the majority of kids aren't top students. There's only one valedictorian in each class, right? So that was just sort of this false dichotomy between you only deserve to stay in this country if you're, you know, have a GPA of 4.6 and you go to Harvard. That doesn't make sense. And I think we've broken that down a little bit now. Also talking about people you wouldn't necessarily expect to be undocumented. It's not just obviously people from Latin America. There are people from the Middle East, some I feature in the book, many Asian American youth who were even more isolated because they didn't have networks like Univision and Telemundo reflecting their experiences. There's a much better understanding, but still there's many places where these students now are feeling more of the need to hide again their identities when for the last 7 years or 6 years they haven't felt that.
Did you feel like, though, there was an arc of expectation that was met with disappointment by the end of the Obama administration? I mean, here we had a relatively liberal administration in hand, but the DREAM Act doesn't pass, and the deferred action for child arrivals, DACA, is an executive order, which is
it's non-permanent. You know, the deferred action for childhood arrivals, DACA, was never meant to be permanent, just like TPS, temporary protected status. It was never meant to be permanent. It was always supposed to be a stopgap measure until Congress would take over. And right now you have this unique situation in our history where you have a president who's very focused on the immigration policy. You have Congress, which, you know, a year and a half ago nearly closed down over the DREAM Act. I mean, there was a government shutdown. And then you have the courts where DACA, this temporary protected status, is now filtering its way up. And so you have immigration sort of playing on all three branches of government, which is really interesting. There was certainly a disappointment that the DREAM Act didn't pass. But I think at the time, many people felt, well, DACA will get us through. And then in the next administration, we'll get the DREAM Act. You know, one of the very visible campaign aides for Hillary Clinton was a young undocumented immigrant. So
President Trump is elected. What changes for the Dreamers once Trump comes in?
Well, the first thing you have to think back is that before he was elected, he met with the Dreamers, including Gabby Pacheco, who was on that march from Miami to Washington. And he said, I have sympathy for these young people. And I write about it in my book. I mean, he expressed a desire initially to help them, even as he was saying these other things. And so I think even the first few months of, you know, or even parts of the first year, people really thought maybe all this hard line language will lead to some compromise, some bill will get something done, which is sort of interesting because when Obama came in, he was saying he wanted to do this broad immigration reform and then also, of course, became deporter in chief. And there is some of that same if he hoped that he's going to do this really hard thing and really crack down and then we'll get something on the other side. And I think there really was still that hope in the beginning of the Trump administration. And I think over time it became more and more clear that that was not going to happen. And so bit by bit, the level of fear and anxiety rose. And the difference is now that many of the undocumented immigrant youth who are protected by DACA have become the main breadwinners for their family. They're the ones who could take out a home mortgage loan. If they lose their status, not only, you know, do they go back into the shadows, but their whole family, their whole network, the people that their parents are hiring, employees and all of that, it has this ripple effect.
So Trump announced he was going to sunset DACA in 2017, but it's been delayed by judicial intervention.
Right. Four courts, California, New York, Maryland, Washington, have ruled against the Trump administration and its efforts to sunset DACA. And there's a case coming up through Texas, and it's expected that the judge will actually rule in favor of the Trump administration because the judge is the same judge who ruled against an expanded version of DACA that was known as DAPA that would have given status to parents of kids who were born here and others. So we already sort of know what that judge is probably going to rule, and the circuit court will probably uphold what he's going to rule. And so it looks like the Supreme Court will probably wait until Texas is sort of resolved. So then you have everything at the appellate level and it can rule. At the same time, though, the Trump administration has put in another petition asking them to rule immediately on the issue, and they could take that up any day.
Do you think that the way that the Trump administration has kind of thrown American focus to the border has changed something for the Dreamers? I mean, has their case sort of lost public attention?
I think it has lost some attention, but the question is, has they lost more support? And when the administration was coming in, I think it was 80% or more Americans believe that the so-called Dreamers should have some path to citizenship. And even if that number has gone down somewhat, I doubt it's gone down a huge amount. So you still have overwhelming support in our country for some solution to their plight in this country. The connection to the border is a strong one. And I think for some, you know, seeing all the dramatic images makes them even more sympathetic to people who've been here. For others, it's scary that, you know, in May there were 144,000 people who were apprehended at the border. And this is a crisis and we need to deal with that. So I think it's played both ways. But I've covered this issue since 2000 and I've always heard the same refrain, you know, we need to get the border under control before we can deal with the people in our country. And that's been 20 years almost. So
on June 4th, you know, the House passed a bill that could give as many as 2.5 million undocumented immigrants a path toward citizenship legalization. The Senate immediately said they wouldn't even take it up, I think. Why do you think the House passed it?
I mean, that's a tricky question, right? With all of legislation, I think they feel like they want to draw a line in the sand. Here's where we stand. This is what we believe in. It also shines a light back on the issue and sort of forces people to take a position because so many people, both in Congress and I think in our country, would just prefer not to deal. Immigration's hard. It's complicated. It's messy. Nobody wants to say no to any child who looks sad at the border. But many people believe we have borders. There has to be a process. You know, we just don't want everyone and anyone just walking across the Rio Grande. So it's a tough issue, and it's just easier for many people to pretend it's not there. But, of course, it's affecting our country and resources and millions of people living here.
What's the bigger impact, though, of the country turning its collective back on this community of people.
We say this community, but I mean, this community is interwoven with every community. I mean, we have teachers, lawyers, students, hotel workers, farm laborers. So this is something that affects all strata of our society. And of course, you don't get resources when people aren't recognized. You don't get resources. So of course, hospitals and areas are affected when they're not getting resources because they're not counting people. Same thing, you can't get health insurance under Obamacare. You couldn't get health insurance if you were undocumented. So you end up being forced to go to the emergency rooms, even if you could pay for it on your own and pay into the insurance program. You have people who are going to charge less because that's the only way they can make a living. So you're pressuring downward on wages. And just in general, civic engagement in our communities. We want people to come together. We want people to show up, to participate in this democracy. You can't have that when people feel that just coming forward and speaking up at a city council meeting could have them put into what they view as exile for 10 years.
Do you feel hopeful that we'll find a resolution of some kind?
I do. I mean, many of the people I followed for my book, some of them are now citizens, and they're very, some are just living their life and doing their thing. Many are very engaged, either in the immigration battle or in much broader issues of social change. I think they care very deeply about this country, and they've seen a lot of injustice, and they know that it's not just a question of necessarily if you have papers or not. You still might not be able to afford housing or go to school. So when I see these young people, I am very hopeful because they're very inspiring. And I know that even as some of them have gotten burnt out, there's a whole new generation coming up that has lived with certain expectations and has that confidence and wants to engage. And also I'm hopeful because people I know are now talking about these issues and understanding it in a way that they didn't when I first started covering this issue. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to have these sort of broader conversations, not just in the immigrant community or the policy wonk community, but with the rest of America.
Did it change the way you thought of what it means to be an American?
Right. What it showed me is here are these young people who don't actually have a passport, which is why I put it on my book. It's the sort of yes or no picture, but yet are so involved in everything that is American in so many ways by being, you know, engaged, showing up to Congress, lobbying their lawmakers. And they're doing everything that we want our young people to do. Not everyone. Obviously, there's people who are not part of this and who are just getting through life and who are even doing bad things. That's true in any population. But so many of these young people are engaged and are doing exactly what we want young Americans to be doing, to be participating in our democracy.
Laura, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That was journalist Laura Wides Munoz speaking with first-person host Sarah Wildman. Wides Munoz's new book is called The Making of a Dream. First Person is produced by Sarah Wildman along with Benjamin Soloway and Maya Gandhi. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. I'm Amy McKinnon. Sarah will be back next Friday. Thanks for listening.